Talking about classic Christmas movies that you ought to watch at some point in your life. So I was kind of interested in what they had to say because you can only watch It's a Wonderful Life so many times. And so I picked up on a couple of the titles and we watched them or tried to this Christmas. It was more or less of a flop, but maybe we should go back to It's a Wonderful Life. But I remembered that there was a Christmas movie that I saw years ago. I think it was a version of this incident that was done by a Christian company. And one of the most touching Christmas movies that I remember, it actually goes back to World War I. And perhaps you are familiar with this story. I'm going to read here a summary of what took place. On Christmas Eve, 1914, in the dank, muddy trenches on the western front of the First World War, a remarkable thing happened. It came to be called the Christmas Truce, and it remains one of the most storied and strangest moments of the Great War or of any war in history. British machine gunner Bruce Bairn's father, later a prominent cartoonist, wrote about it in his memoirs. Like most of his fellow infantrymen of the 1st Battalion of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, he was spending the holiday eve shivering in the muck, trying to keep warm. He had spent a good part of the past few months fighting the Germans. And now in a part of Belgium called Bois de Ploegsteert, he was crouched in a trench that stretched just 3 feet deep by 3 feet wide, his days and nights marked by an endless cycle of sleeplessness and fear, stale biscuits and cigarettes too wet to light. Here I was in this horrible clay cavity, he wrote, miles and miles from home, cold, wet, and covered with mud. There didn't seem the slightest chance of leaving, except in an ambulance. At about 10 p.m., Bairn's father noticed a noise. I listened. Away across the field, among the dark shadows beyond, I could hear the murmur of voices. He turned to a fellow soldier in his trench and said, "Do you hear the Germans kicking up that racket over there?" "Yes," came the reply. "They've been at it some time." The Germans were singing carols, and it was Christmas Eve. In the darkness, some of the British soldiers began to sing back. Suddenly, we heard a confused shouting from the other side. We all stopped to listen. The shout came again. The voice was from an enemy soldier speaking in English with a strong German accent. He was saying, "Come over here." One of the British sergeants answered, "You come halfway, I come halfway." What happened next would, in the years to come, stun the world and make history. Enemy soldiers began to climb nervously out of their trenches and to meet in the barbed wire-filled no-man's land that separated the armies. Normally, the British and Germans communicated across no-man's land with streaking bullets, with only occasional gentlemanly allowances to collect the dead unmolested. But now there were handshakes and words of kindness. The soldiers traded songs, tobacco, in a spontaneous holiday party in the cold night. Bairn's father could not believe his eyes. Here they were, the actual soldiers of the German army. There was not an atom of hate on either side. And it wasn't confined to that one battlefield. Starting on Christmas Eve, small pockets of French, German, Belgian, and British troops held impromptu ceasefires across the Western Front, with reports of some on the Eastern Front as well. Some accounts suggest a few of these unofficial truces remained in effect for days. For those who participated, it was surely a welcome break from the hell that they had been enduring. When the war had begun just 6 months earlier, most soldiers figured it would be over very quickly and they'd be home with their families in time for the holidays. Not only could the war drag on for 4 more years, but it would prove to be the bloodiest ever up to that time. By the time winter approached in 1914 and the chill set in, the Western Front stretched hundreds of miles. Countless soldiers were living in misery in the trenches on the fronts, while tens of thousands had already died. And then Christmas came. They go on to recount this. One British fighter named Ernie Williams later described in an interview his recollection of some makeshift soccer play on what had turned out to be an icy pitch. The ball appeared from somewhere. I don't know where. They made up some goals, and one fellow went in goal, and then it was just a general kickabout. I should think there were about a couple hundred taking part. And you can actually go to an area in a park set aside in England today that's commemorating World War I, and they have a sort of a frame of a ball with two hands shaking, memorializing this event when the soldiers put everything aside on Christmas to play soccer, to celebrate what I'm sure for some of them was a genuine belief in the birth of Christ, and that transcended everything that pulled them apart, and for that brief moment of time brought them to experience a measure of peace. Well, that day, in the crushing darkness that was World War I, those weary soldiers, they caught a glimmer of light on Christmas. And that's a very helpful image to keep in mind as we come to this text, because this passage was also written in the context of war, and it speaks about the agony of a war-torn people and their longing for hope, their longing for deliverance and for victory. But it's so different from what those Germans and British soldiers experienced. Not just a passing glimmer of light and of hope, and then the next day the fighting resumes. What we're reading here in Isaiah chapter 9 is a beacon of hope that announces a permanent end to all hostility on God's earth, and it is worked out through the Messiah who is prophesied in Isaiah chapter 9. Light overtakes the gloom of warfare. That is the atmosphere, that is the setting of this passage, and that is the title of our message on this day, day after Christmas 2021. And it becomes a little hard to really appreciate it. And what a dramatic moment this is in this passage without considering something in the broader context in which Isaiah chapter 9 occurs. We have been reading through the chapters leading up to this over the last few weeks here on Sunday mornings. We still have a stretch to go before we end the unit that this is a part of, but it really stretches all the way from chapter 7 to chapter 12 of Isaiah. And I want to give you a sense of the big picture of these chapters so that we can have an appreciation of just how significant of a turning point chapter 9 is. A lot of people refer to Isaiah chapter 7 through chapter 12 as the book of Emmanuel, because you have two occasions when that name Emmanuel is used as a proper name, and then there's another reference to God with us, which is really the same Hebrew term. All three of those in this set of chapters, and they really set it off. They are distinctive of this particular group of passages. You might remember some of the things that we have read about, but it actually starts out with a lot of gloom and a lot of uncertainty and a lot of despair during the time of the reign of a man named Ahaz. And that takes us back to chapter 7. And the fact that Ahaz was overcome by fear because he was getting pressure from his enemies to the north, which would be actually his own ultimately countrymen, the northern kingdom of Israel, plus the Syrians beyond that had joined together and were getting ready to invade or to invade again the tribe of Judah. And Ahaz didn't know what to do. And he was considering calling for help from the other side altogether, the eastern empire of the Assyrians, that they would come to his aid, that they would distract these closer enemies, get them off of his back, and deliver him from this crisis. And in that moment, Isaiah is sent by God to give this really wicked, idolatrous man a message of hope that God was well able to deliver the people of Judah from that threat, that he didn't need to get the aid of this pagan king in Assyria. And that is the focus of verses 1 to 16 of Isaiah chapter 7. God's deliverance of Judah from that threat that Israel and Syria were pressing upon them. And as the clinching proof, as the ultimate encouragement to Ahaz to believe the promises of God, we find that prophecy about the virgin-born child whose name is Emmanuel. It becomes the greatest possible, the greater to lesser argument for why you should believe in God's delivering you from this relatively small crisis, and that is that one day, out of commitment to the line of David, God is going to raise up a descendant born of a virgin, God himself living with his people, to restore the kingdom and to demonstrate his faithfulness to the promises that were made to David. That was the essence of that prophecy about Emmanuel. Well, God was committed to do that, but Ahaz actually did not believe the Lord, and he did send for help from the Assyrians, and it was in the short term a workable solution, but it just opened up a Pandora's box of all kinds of other problems that Ahaz had no idea were coming upon him. And actually, things descend pretty low in the next chapter or so, as picking up in chapter 7, verse 17, and all the way to chapter 8, verse 22, you have this prediction that those same Assyrians that, for the moment, had been there to help them, were actually going to oppress and humiliate and abuse them, and Ahaz would come to regret the decision that he had made. And so things descend, and they become pretty bleak. They become pretty dark. But, of course, that's not where it ends either. It's really at the end of that pretty heavy stuff in chapter 8. You remember last week the reading ended with all of this about gloom and anguish and thick darkness. It's at the end of that that we come to the passage that we just read from chapter 9 of God's, again, ultimate intent, the greatest demonstration of his commitment to his promises, to his people, and that is this king that is anticipated in the first 7 verses of chapter 9. And even though that is a mountaintop, it's not the end of the passage either. It's not the end of the story. And things actually descend pretty quickly right away. If you cross the line into chapter 9, verse 8, you read there an account of all kinds of injustices that were being committed, particularly by the northern kingdom, and how God was intent on judging those people for the way that they had treated others. And when we come back next year and continue reading here through Isaiah, we're going to see, again, just how heavy and how dark those judgments are. But thankfully, that's not the end of it either. Because even though in the shorter term, God did use the Assyrians to judge his people, there was coming a day pretty quickly where he was going to hold them accountable as well. And in chapter 10, he goes on to speak about how the Lord was going to judge these pagan peoples that for a time had been his instruments of judgment, but like the Israelites, had also abused their authority and their position and had gone over the top in the way that they had treated their enemies and the oppression that he brought upon them when they conquered. And so the Lord is going to judge them as well. Well, at that point, like he does on other occasions, it's like Isaiah is standing on the peak of the mountain, and he is looking out at this horizon, and even though there may be a bunch of valleys in between that represent a lot of time and a lot of other events in the plan of God, he looks ahead to later peaks that in God's mind, because God sees all of time as one, and he knows everything he intends to do, and he is not worried about these temporary setbacks or defeats or judgments. Isaiah looks across the horizon, jumping all over whatever valleys of time might be in between, and he sees the next big thing, and really the ultimate thing that the Lord has in store for his people, and it is the amazing promise of the kingdom of the Messiah in Isaiah chapter 11. And we will actually end in that passage this morning, but you'll recognize some of the wording there that anticipates the bringing about of peace throughout the earth through the Lord Jesus Christ. And then there's just a little bit of this context left in chapter 12, where in response to all that God intends to do, Isaiah actually gives these people a little song to sing. And that's the first six verses of Isaiah chapter 12, is he's actually giving them an inspired hymn to lift up to the Lord, praising him and glorifying him for all that he has done or all that he will do as the Messiah returns to establish his kingdom on earth. And so there you have the full scope of the main events that are anticipated in Isaiah chapter 7 to 12. And at the heart of that, fleshing out in more detail the Emmanuel prophecy and setting up for the glorious kingdom of chapter 11, at the heart of that, and as the fulcrum of it all, is the passage that was read for us and what we're considering together this morning. Now let's look at that passage. And this perhaps is familiar not just from the reading, but because it's often quoted at Christmas time. But typically we jump down to verses 6 and 7, and the verses that are all about the deliverer and the king that's going to come, and we maybe don't understand what this is all about or why this is such great news. You want to notice that verse 5 begins with the word for, which is giving you a cause for something that is described earlier. And then actually, verse 6 follows up with the word for or because as well. And then verse 7 begins with a statement just continuing to bear out the reason that is given in verse 6 about the ongoing rule of the Messiah who's introduced. Verse 4 begins with the word for as well. When you get all these reasons piling up, you need to ask, well, how is this all connected? What is a reason for what? And why should we keep all of this together? What is the flow of thought? Well, the sequence of thought really does move in a succession. And it moves us from one sort of surface cause and then to a deeper cause and then to a more fundamental cause. In other words, something is proclaimed or prophesied, and God says, here's why that's going to happen. And then he says, now here's why that's going to happen. And then he says, here's why that's going to happen. There's this decreasing sequence that gets you further and further down to the bottom of why God is able to promise what he does at the beginning of the chapter. So what does he promise? He promises that those who have suffered under the darkness of pagan oppression, ultimately suffering the consequences of their own sin, their lives filled with gloom and despair, that day is going to come to an end because God is going to shine upon them the light of deliverance. There will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. And you say, well, what is that talking about? And it continues to explain what's taking place. There's all this joy of deliverance. There's all of this peace that these people are experiencing because, verse 4, here's the first reason. The yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor you have broken as on the day of Midian. In other words, they have light and they have joy because there are no more oppressions. Nobody in authority is taking advantage of that for their personal gain and mistreating people made in the image of God. Nobody is abusing their power in the world like so often happens when people get into positions of authority. And in fact, there is an even greater reason. Nobody is going to oppress because, verse 5 goes on to say, every boot of the tramping warrior and every garment rolled in blood is going to be burned as fuel for the fire. So the reason for all the light and joy is that there's no oppression, and the reason for that is that there is no more warfare. Can you imagine a world where the concept of warfare just doesn't exist? It is no longer a concern. In fact, as we read later on, people are going to take their implements of warfare, they're going to turn them into instruments of agriculture because there's no more tension among the peoples. There are no border skirmishes. There are no battling ideologies. There is no more egomaniac trying to establish his power all over the world. There's no reason for warfare. And you say, wow, how could that possibly be given the history of mankind, given the tendencies of the human heart to be hostile, to be selfish, to be self-protective? How can there be a world where there is no oppression because there is no warfare? Everybody is getting along perfectly. Well, here now is the bottom line. And that's why verse 6 begins with the word for. Because to us a child is born, to us a son is given. That is the reason that all of these warfares are going to be done away with and the world will be filled with light and joy. That coming of the messianic child is the explanation for the elimination of warfare in the world. He is the reason that light will overtake the gloom. He himself is the light of the world who overtakes the gloom. And we don't have to wait to a later day because that process has already begun with his arrival and what we celebrate at Christmas. And as we look then at verses 6 and 7, this text showcases for us three aspects of the Messiah that illuminate the darkness of the world, that will bring about the peaceful conditions in chapter 9, and that minister to us hope in the midst of despair. So let's consider, first of all, there at the beginning of verse 6, that light overtakes the gloom because of the Messiah's human nature. Light overtakes the gloom because of the Messiah's human nature. Now, probably the most amazing part of this verse is what we're going to read about in the second part of it. And it's going to get us to a totally different theme as it gets into the deity of the Messiah. But actually, when Isaiah begins to write about the reason that warfare is going to go away and the world will be filled with light, what he focuses on, first of all, is the humanity of the Messiah. He says, to us a child is born, to us a son is given. Yes, there are these other traits that inspire confidence and hope in him. But there is this inescapable and necessary reality that he is a human being and he comes into the world as a child. I want us to think about that simple truth, the specific thing that we celebrate at Christmas, the humanity of this child. And the fact that he was born as a baby, not just a genuine human being, kind of coming in full grown like Adam was created, but coming in the form of a child, the way this passage predicts. What's the significance of that? And how is that a part of the light that overtakes the gloom? I would say it has everything to do with the message of Isaiah as a whole. And there are two implications of the Messiah being a child, as is predicted here, that I want to bring out for us to make that point. First of all, born as a child, this man relates to us in our weakness. He relates to us in our weakness. There are many things you could say about a baby, but maybe the overriding thing is that a baby, for as alive as he or she may be, is fundamentally helpless. And our new mothers in this building can appreciate just how helpless a newborn is. He or she is entirely dependent on other people for food, for clothing, for shelter, for hygiene, for protection. A baby can do nothing for himself, can't even talk. All that the baby can do is cry out in order to make his or her needs known. And we're very used to that. And this is just a normal part of human development. And our hearts go out to these vulnerable, helpless infants. And we want to do what we can to help. We have the resources to help. We're used to that concept when it comes to ordinary children. But the point is, that is how the Messiah entered the world also. He submitted himself to that process of genuine humanity that includes total dependence on others in the initial stages of his life. And this is one of the really touching things about Christmas. Flesh, which we'll get to the God part in a moment, but we don't want to miss the in the flesh part, and really not just in the flesh, God in the baby part. The totally helpless, relying for everything upon his parents. Well, over time, that baby does grow up. But until the time that he is self-sustaining and what we would call an adult, going through these different periods of childhood and youth, he still remains dependent upon and subordinate to his parents. He knows very little. And it's a whole long process to develop the knowledge and to develop the wherewithal to navigate life on his own. He has to go through a process of growth that ideally includes a sense of yieldedness to the wisdom of those who have been around longer on the earth than he has. And I think about the description of Jesus in those terms as well. When Luke tells us that he went down with his parents after the experience of the feast in Jerusalem, and he came to Nazareth, and he was submissive to them. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. It becomes very hard for us to explain how all of this worked, because he did have a 100% divine nature that in and of itself was omniscient and all-powerful, no need for growth, no need for experience, no need for development. The years of his incarnation, there was a voluntary holding back of the expression of some of the attributes of his deity. You want to remember, most of his demonstration of deity was not about himself. The working of miracles to help other people and deliver those who were demon-possessed or sick or whatever. But in terms of his own basic existence in life, the meeting of his needs, his life experiences, he was not drawing all the time on his divine attributes to get along in life. He went through a normal process of human is describing there. And it was physical, it was social, it was spiritual, it was emotional, and it was also intellectual. He can relate to us in our weakness. I find this to be applicable in a number of different directions. I'm a teacher, and I have students. and talking about the Lord relating to us in our weakness. When we are struggling to learn something, to study some subject, to master some bit of information that we need as a part of our education, it really is a striking thought. Jesus went to school. Maybe not like we conceive of schools, but he studied in the normal process that Jewish boys did back then. And he did not know everything all at once. There was the normal development of basic factual and practical knowledge that he developed by doing what? By submitting to those who were more experienced than he. So it's not just an encouragement that he relates to us in our weakness when we struggle to learn what we need to learn. But children, y'all ought to be challenged by the statement that he was also submissive to his parents. He was so in a moment of weakness, vulnerability, dependence, that he actually chose to come under the authority and yield his will to the will of people that, as far as his own divine nature, he had created and knew infinitely more than they did. But in the days of his humanity, in his childhood, he made the choice, I'm going to yield to them. And he can relate, all right? Practical, even for children. When you struggle to obey mom and dad, and you don't like it that somebody's telling you what to do, think about this. Jesus was a child. He had to submit to mom and dad as well. He was a genuine human. He knows the difficulty of that way more than you do because you didn't create your parents. And you don't know the degree of their depravity and their own struggle like Jesus knew about Joseph and Mary. And nevertheless, he made the choice to remain under their authority. Born as a child, he relates to our weakness. You know, even adults, we like weakness as well. Even though we get along in life and develop, there's always somebody smarter, there's always somebody stronger than we are, and sometimes people in authority overcome us because of their greater strength. In fact, that is the original context of Isaiah, as I pointed out. The people of Judah suffering oppression and abuse at the hands, first of all, and then later on from the Assyrians. They were experiencing oppression and that sort of feeling of vulnerability and helplessness where I am overcome and I can do nothing to deliver myself. We ought to be encouraged by the fact that our Lord can relate to that as well. In fact, this very book goes on to say about him in chapter 53 that he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He not only went through the sort of normal dependency of a child, but he went through the unusual sense of dependency of the Lord, on the Lord when he suffered the abuse, the oppression of the cross. And so this is part of what gives us hope in this passage, that born as a child, he relates to our weakness. The question then is going to be, when he experiences those moments of weakness, particularly the oppression side of things, how is he going to respond at that point? And here is, born as a child, he also exemplifies humility. Jesus humbled himself in many ways, and a big part of it was his choice to rely upon the Father to deliver taking matters immediately into his own hands. In fact, Isaiah 53 goes on to say that like a lamb that is led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And it's not just that he went through periods of need and vulnerability, but that he waited on the Father for deliverance. He humbled himself and waited. Now that does get you to the heart of the message of the book of Isaiah, like the whole thing. What is this book all about? This book, in short, is about learning to humbly trust Yahweh as the Holy One of Israel. It is about posturing yourself before the Lord as his servant. It entails not only being willing to do what he guides you to do, but it also includes the humility of admitting, I cannot deliver myself. I do not have the resources in me to free myself from the suffering of this life, to deal adequately with whatever oppression I might face, or even to just get along in the basic necessities of life. And I'm making the choice, humbling myself, to cast my needs entirely before the Lord instead of doing the other option, which the Bible describes as relying on the arm of the flesh. You remember, perhaps, the great summary verse of Isaiah, which is chapter 57 and verse 15. And it describes the Lord as what? As the High and Holy One, who inhabits eternity. But it also describes who has a special heart of people who are contrite and lowly in spirit. He comes in to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. The main point of this book of Isaiah as a whole, to bring people to have that spirit of contrition and humility before the Lord. It's exactly what Ahaz did not demonstrate when he went out and he looked for the king of Assyria to help. But it's exactly what his son Hezekiah did do when those Assyrians were surrounding Jerusalem. And this time Hezekiah has nowhere to go like his dad did. And what does he do? But he takes that letter. You remember that story? Where there were all of these threats from the Assyrian Empire, and he just brings it before Isaiah had been encouraging him to do, and he says, Lord, act on behalf of deliver myself, take pity on us, deliver us, and in one night, what happens? 185,000 Assyrian soldiers, and Sennacherib goes running back home with his tail between his legs. Those two stories are opposites of each other in illustrating what Isaiah is getting at. Here is what not to do. Here is what to do, casting yourself exclusively on the Holy One of Israel. And what I'm saying here is that the childlike nature of the Messiah points us to the fact he demonstrated that spirit. This is the kind of Messiah, however many great things we still need to see about him, this is the spirit of humility that he is marked by. And I love this statement from John Oswalt. He says, this point underlines the central paradox in Isaiah's deliverance of his people. How will God deliver from arrogance, war, oppression, and coercion? Deliver people who are under the thumb of very proud people. Is it going to be by being more arrogant, more warlike, more oppressive, and more coercive? Surely the book of Isaiah indicates frequently that God was powerful enough to destroy. Yet again and again, when the prophet comes to the heart of deliverance, listen to this, when he comes, how it is God is going to deliver, a childlike face peers out at us. Forces of the world, you've got this little baby staring at you. That's the means that he's going to use to bring about the deliverance. God is strong enough to overcome his enemies, by becoming vulnerable, transparent, and humble. In fact, that is the only hope for turning enmity into friendship. God is strong enough to overcome his enemies by becoming vulnerable. Light because of the Messiah's human nature. And of course, that's at the heart of the Messiah's accomplishment of our redemption. We read about that in Isaiah 53 as well, that baby was born, but he also has borne, B-O-R-N-E, our griefs, and carried our sorrows. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement. With his wounds, we are healed. That spirit of humility on his part, his willingness in our place, was really the key to our salvation. Light overcome nature. But we do come to the other side, and there is such a in the second gloom because of the Messiah's divine qualities. That's the rest of Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6. We speak now here of his ability to bring about the victory, to reign over the kingdom of God, to exercise justice and rule. But really, some of that, in general, could be said about any king of Israel or Judah. Any pagan king at any moment in history could be described as a mighty ruler and being successful in what he intends to do. But at some point, all of them ended up failing. In some way, they all fell short. None of them brought the ultimate successful in the long term. Persuades us that the Messiah is going to be capable of doing that is by giving us a little list of his names. Or we might say his titles. That's what the rest of verse 6 is revealing for us. Various titles that will be given to the Messiah that speak to his capacity for carrying out successfully what this passage describes. And he's called, first of all, literally here, a wonder of a counselor. Wonderful counselor, which speaks about his matchless wisdom. Here is part of the paradox. If for a time he was holding back all of his knowledge or a lot of his knowledge and wisdom as God, learning as a child, but the day is going to come when that period of learning and growth is over and the fullness of his deity is made plain and he's going to have the fullness of understanding to discern the best way to achieve the peace. Within himself, the world's most complicated problems. That's what a wonder of a counselor is getting at. One of the translations puts it this way, an extraordinary strategist. And actually, you could put it more strongly than that because the word wonder in the Bible isn't just talking about something in general that's amazing. It's talking about something that is divine. It's talking about such an extraordinary level of wisdom that it's in a totally different category. It doesn't have a human origin. Matchless wisdom. Now, as we think about that, I wanted to point out that so far I've been assuming that in fact this passage is talking about Jesus. And I think we are agreed on that, but if you ever wonder how do we know that? One of the ways we know that is that there is a striking quotation of this passage in the New Testament with reference to the ministry of Jesus and to this point about. We won't take the time to turn there, but it's actually in Matthew chapter 4. And it's at the outset of Jesus' ministry. began to teach and to call his disciples, and it was in the northern part of Israel, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, and specifically Capernaum. And as Jesus is beginning his ministry in that region, and Matthew is wanting to demonstrate what's going on, what does he do but to quote from Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 to 2? And he says, what's happening here is a reflection of what Isaiah said about Zebulun and Naphtali in this area that was dominated by the Gentiles way up there in the north. They had lived in gloom. The light is going to shine on them. And now Jesus comes and he starts his teaching. And guess what's happening right after that? As our Lord begins his ministry of urging people to repent and gathering a band of disciples to follow him and work with him, before long, he is sitting on the side of a mountain in that same region that is Jewish and Gentile people, and he begins to say things like this: blessed are the poor in spirit, for the kingdom of heaven, Matthew 5:3, and that of the sermon. It is a sermon recognized by people that don't even believe in Jesus as one of the highest achievements of ethical teaching in history. It is a reflection of the wisdom that we're talking about here. And I want to, in that light, if you think about Jesus, can you give me some of your supernatural counsel? World, I can't even figure out what to do when I get out of bed in the morning. I need help. I need direction. How am I supposed to live? How am I supposed to relate to other people? What do you expect of me arranged under your authority? What does this look like? He says, well, I gave you this. What that is about. It is a reflection of my master to direct how to be and what your relationship should look like and what your words ought to be characterized by. Even how you ought to respond to those who are your enemies. Everything is laid out there in essence. Relationship to God, horizontally relationship to people. It's all there in summary form in the Sermon on the Mount. This is the display of the matchless wisdom of Jesus that was taught in this very region that Isaiah is describing up there in Zebulun and Naphtali and Galilee. And I want to encourage you, maybe this time of the year as we're ending one year and heading into another, wisdom, as we embark on another year with all of its uncertainty and its, what do we need? How do I make decisions? What should be my goals? What should my life look like? Maybe this would be a great time to rehearse again the wisdom of Jesus. But you know, you can have a lot of great ideas and not have the... And that's where this next quality comes in, where he is described literally as a god of a hero, meaning not just a god, but God whose energies are directed in strength in battle. Or somebody has said, quote, a hero, a military hero, whose chief characteristic, this is one of the Bible's strongest, and if you ever wonder whether it is a statement of his deity, go sometime to chapter 10, verses 20 and 21, you'll see the a mighty God used for Yahweh. He doesn't have just great ideas. Within himself, all the might that is needed to execute his brilliant. But there is more. There is unending love. We sang about that this morning. That is the thrust of this other title, the Everlasting Father. And don't get the doctrine of the Trinity. We understand that in terms of the being of God, there are these three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That's not what is under discussion here, and the Trinity is only very lightly hinted at in the Old Testament. What this is talking about is actually the way things of nations were referred to as fathers over their people. Because the king had this role of standing up for them, fighting them in battle, and protecting. In chapter 22 and verse 21, one of the rulers of God's people, Eliakim, is referred to as a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. You're talking about Jesus there in his role as a fatherly, shepherdly kind of ruler, guiding his people and doing for them in tender care and protection. What a good abusive authorities that they had in the past. And Christ is able to do this forever. He does this everlastingly. He's never going to be voted out. He's never going to die. He will forever serve as a fatherly king toward his people. And then finally, he is described as well as the prince. He is peace itself. Not just the prince who is himself peace. That's the idea. Yes, at a certain point, he is going to have to exercise dreadful force who persist in rebellion against. But having eliminated that opposition out, sort of calming things down and ending hostility, it is about wholeness in the world, where everything and carrying out role, that's the fuller significance of peace. And of course, that he accomplished that, yes, warfare someday to bring it about finally, but the essence of it is through the blood of his cross. And so all of these things in some way speak to the divine nature of the Messiah, and another and light overtakes the gloom is because of his glorious reign. Which this verse, verse 7, describes in three ways. It is an eternal reign, it is a just and righteous reign, and it is a successful reign. Of what other earthly king could that be said? And what a comfort to his people who had for so long authorities. Whether those authorities, as often sadly is the case, were parents or employers or civil governors, this is what the people of God have to look forward to. Light overtakes the gloom because of the glorious reign. And if you want a fuller description of what that looks like, jump ahead to chapter 11. And I'm not going to read all of this, but you talk about somebody in authority, a governor characterized by this sort of description. I'm looking at verse 3 of chapter 11. His delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor. And it's because of that that you have the word righteousness showing up a number of times in these kinds of contexts, words like peace and the obliteration of warfare. Look at verse 9. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Now, our world and our country are in turmoil for many reasons. And maybe the word turmoil, you would say, is a good one to describe the circumstances of your personal life as well. This morning, I'm just wanting to showcase for you that Jesus meets the longings and the aspirations of the human heart for somebody who knows what to do and has the ability to carry it out successfully and for all eternity. That is the process with that little baby, and he came in so helpless. And over time, Isaiah chapter 11 is the end of the story. Now, somebody truly believes that? And if you're persuaded of that such that your hope for your life now and for all eternity is that alone, I want to tell you what the appropriate response is, because Isaiah does give us a hymn that is the response. Look at chapter 12. And here's how I want us to end this morning. You see there pretty quickly in verse 1 that there are some quotation marks. And that's the beginning of the hymn. And I want us to recite this together as a way of celebrating what we've considered this morning. I'm just going to read that one line at the beginning, you will say in that day, and then we'll all read verses 1 to 6 together. We have the opportunity to say it now, even as we're going to say it someday in the future. You will say in that day, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, for though you were angry with me, your anger turned away that you might comfort me. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid, for the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. With joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. And you will say in that day, give thanks to the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the peoples. Proclaim that his name is exalted. Sing praises to the Lord, for he has done gloriously in all the earth. Shout and sing for joy, O inhabitant of Zion, for great in your midst is the Holy One of Israel. Well, someday we are going to know the tune that we're supposed to use for that song. In the meantime, we're going to sing another tune. You can turn to